Mr. Boxall, Real 8. During the time at Germany, did you stay with B Company? I think that's just something we want to sort out.
No, in 1949, early 49, I was there was a changeover in the battalion, and I was posted to A Company, as Company Sergeant Major of A Company.
And who was your officer there? Can you remember?
No, not sure.
Okay. Now, did anything else happen in Germany before you moved back to Dover?
Well, we used to go once or twice. We went up to Sennelager to the ranges and did various exercises and exercise ride with tanks and in a tank assault. But it was generally normal training, sport, and normal barrack duties.
And did you have any? I mean, you were meant to be going to Hong Kong and just doing for a while. Were you aware of the plans?
We were never told that we were going to Hong Kong. We were told we were coming home to England, being posted home to England to Dover Castle, and that was as far as we knew.
So what happened? What's the next stage? We
came home to England at Dover Castle in February 51. And there we took in some national servicemen and trained them. But we were only two or three months in Dover Castle, and then we moved to Crowborough, to a Huddick camp in Crowborough.
Now, can I just ask about this training of national servicemen? What was your opinion of national servicemen and the way they accepted the training? Were they as good as regulars? What did you feel generally?
Well, no, they... they were there, a lot of them didn't want to be in the army, had no interest in it, but they eventually became fairly good soldiers. and when you're being fired at or shells are dropping, they don't select national servicemen to kill and not regular soldiers. They don't drop and say, oh, we can't hit him because he's a regular soldier. They're all the same. So there's no... you know, once you get on active service with them, they've got to do their job the same as everybody else.
And you felt that once they got over this initial reluctance, they were as good
material. Yeah. Once they got over the... In fact, when we were in Korea, I rather admired them because they got on with the life. They did the job as they were had to. But when we moved to Crowborough, it was when
ask about the Dover Castle barracks, what they were like? Because it's quite a dramatic place.
Well, there were barrack blocks built inside the castle grounds. And they were normal sort of army barrack blocks, big rooms with perhaps 20 beds in. There weren't anything special, there weren't anything... sort of really outrageous. They weren't old dungeons that we were living in. They were proper purpose-built barrack blocks, but they'd been built sometime, I think, before the First World War. So they were...
Were you aware of all the tunnels and the things at Dover?
Well, I was, because one day the company commander and I were taken down into the tunnels to have a look at the old wartime RAF operations room that was inside the tunnel.
What was it like down there? Because...
Well, it was like being in a huge railway station, really. It was all lit up, there were lights, there was everything there for people to live for weeks on end if they needed to. And that was quite interesting. It was an interesting afternoon to go down and have a look, see what it was like, you know, during the war when they were using it.
And you moved to Crowborough in June?
Yeah. And it was there just after the day after we moved, that we were told that we were going to go to Korea.
Now, that did cause problems in the unit, because a lot of the national servicemen didn't have enough time. Can you talk and about the problems you faced?
Well, some of the national servicemen didn't have long enough to do so. They weren't going. They had to be posted away. We had other national servicemen posted in from... the Essex Regiment, from Beds and Hearts and places like that, regiments like that, to bring us up to complement with the soldiers that we needed. The same thing with the senior ranks. Some of the senior ranks didn't have long enough, were near the end of their time. Some of them weren't able to go because they were ex-FEPOWs and they weren't allowed to go to Korea. So they had to be replaced, and we had people in from other regiments. And in Cobra, that got back to being, you know, a unit, and everybody got to know each other.
How well did the other drafts fit in? I mean, you were Norfolk, so well, how did they fit in?
They fitted in. They had to fit in, didn't they? I mean, there's no good saying, oh, sorry, I'm Beds and Arts. I don't want anything at all to do with the Norfolks, because you've got to, you're posted there, you've got to do what you're told, and that's the end of it.
And what other preparations were made?
Well, it was getting the kit all sorted out. We obviously needed a khaki drill, or not khaki drill, green drill, because it was we'd be going out there, at, you know, late part of the summer, so we'd be wearing that. But then, of course, they had to organise also the issue of winter kit for when we got to Korea, because very soon after we got, well, the November, December, winter set in, and you needed windproof clothing and parkas and all sorts of things. So that had to be catered for, although we were in England and it wasn't winter. You can't just suddenly on the onset of winter start whistling up all the different types of clothing and supplies that you need. That all had to be catered for, and that was a job for the quartermaster's department.
But you were still CSM?
Well, I was still CSM, yeah. Yeah, of A Company.
Now, did you get embarkation leave?
Yeah, we had a month.
What did you do with your leave?
Well, I went up to York to my wife and my son, but my wife was pregnant and my daughter was born whilst I was on embarkation leave. In fact, I got my wife out of the nursing home with a baby on a Friday and had to leave on the Saturday. So I saw my daughter for a very, very short time.
How did you feel generally about having to go again? I mean, you'd served in the Second World War. I mean, I know you were a regular, but I mean...
We always said, my wife always said, you take the money when the going's good, and when the going's bad, you keep your trap shut and get on with it. And that is quite true, you do. I mean, I was a regular soldier. I knew what I was signing on for when I signed on, even at 16. I knew that if I was ordered to go to war or go into dangerous situations, I had to go. And it's no good arguing about it and crying and saying, no, I don't want to go, it's too bloody late. Once you're signed on, you're there.
Now, what do you remember of the voyage, the journey out? You left in the last day of August.
Yeah. We went on the Empire Orwell. There again, this time it was training on the boat. We had to, did all sorts of training. Did unarmed combat training. We fired at, they put stuff over the side and we fired at it with rifles over the back of the ship and things like that. When we got to Port Said, I don't think we did so at, I don't know whether we called in at Gibraltar, I can't remember. But when we got to Port Said, we had shore leave, yeah, we did a route march around Port Said to keep ourselves going.
You seem to have stopped quite a bit en route, Port Said, Aden, Port Said, Colombo, Aden, Singapore,
yeah,
Hong Kong.
We didn't get ashore at Aden. We did get ashore at Singapore for a shore leave for just one day or one afternoon. Hong Kong, we called in there, but I don't think we went ashore. We didn't get shore leave there. And then, of course, it was then on to finish up at Pusan. We docked at Pusan.
And just what were conditions like on board?
Well, it was a German liner that had been requisitioned at the end of the war, as war reparations. It had all Stanley berths, and, of course, warrant officers were and sergeants were all in cabins, so it was a bit more civilised than it was the first ships that I went on. It was quite a pleasant voyage out, really.
Now, what do you remember your arrival in Pusan?
Well, Pusan was favouritely termed the backside of the world, and it was. You can practically smell it about 25 miles out to sea, and it was one of the most filthiest places I'd ever seen. Open sewers, and the place stank. In fact, as far as I could see, Korea wasn't in it very much better. There was a whole lot of it. I mean, all right, Seoul was a city, but once you got outside of that, there were no paved roads. They were all tracks carved out the hillsides by the army, bulldozers and that. And it was where the villages were sort of little wooden huts with straw roofs, and there was but no very big towns, not in the part we were in anyway.
Do you remember being met by the United States band?
When we docked, the United States band sort of played on the quayside for us. They were quite good as well. They were a bit better than the military, our military bands, because it didn't matter what you shouted out for them to play, they played it. Jazz, all sorts of stuff they played. They were good. They were good, and they were quite, it was quite good, but we weren't there long. Once we disembarked, we got got on a train and went up to a camp. I think they called it Eden Camp, was it, or something like that?
Well, I think it's Britannia Camp.
Oh, the Britannia Camp, that's what they probably called it, yeah.
I think it was further north, so they called it that.
And
now, this was about 30 miles north of Seoul.
Yeah, north of Seoul, yeah.
Now, was the train journey, what was that like? I mean, was it any different from India? What
it was, of course, we weren't on there any length of time, 2 or 3 hours, I suppose. We got up to Britannia Camp and sort of got ourselves in. But that night, after we got in the afternoon, that night, A Company were warned they got to move up to take over from, I think it was A Company of the Cosbys on a feature called 355, which was later termed Little Gibraltar by the Americans. But we had to move out the next day straight away to take over from this company on 355. And, of course, there was no... that was a climb up from the valley, up the hill. And by the time we got to the top, most of them were pretty winded because we hadn't sort of done much moving about on board ship or anything. And we took over from them there and were then in the line.
You were taken over from the company of the King John
Scottish Borderers.
And what was the terrain like? Can you describe that first?
It was all hills and valleys. There was very little flat ground. 355 overlooked the Samichon Valley, and that was a part that we. Oh no, not the Samichon Valley. Sorry, no, that overlooked one valley, but. And we stayed there. We were up on 355 for a few days.
This is in the Koang San.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. And we moved down onto a feature, and became part of the battalion. Came up and came into the line, and we became part of the battalion again.
So tell us about the time. How long were you with the Cosbys?
We weren't with the Cosbys. We were a separate company of our own.
Attached
but
to them,
yeah.
Sorry,
yeah. Yeah, well, we didn't see much of them. I mean...
How long were you?
How long? Two or three days. Not very long at all.
And what were the positions like you took over?
Well, there were slit trenches and communication trenches. We found out was you had all your admin and things all around the back of the hill. And then all your fighting trenches, your slit trenches, were around the front of the hill. And they were connected with a trench a long trench that was dug into the hillside, so that you could get round undercover. So all your sleeping quarters and that were around the back of the hill, but the communication trench took you round to the fighting slit trenches in the front of the hill.
And did anything happen in these 2 or 3 days? Or was
no,
it just
nothing. That was a fairly quiet time. Most of the sort of big fighting had finished when they sort of sorted the thing out after the Gloucesters were captured, some time before we got there.
And so you stayed with them, and then did you move back, or did
we moved off to the right to a little feature they called Finger. And we were on there, we moved down onto there.
And his finger was off?
To the right of, as you looked at the, as we were on 355, when you looked off to the right of it, there was a little feature called Finger that we, well, we called it Finger.
It's actually attached to 355.
Yeah, but a good way down from it. And there we established our company. We had platoons on all along the front there, and the company commander was Major Gibbons, who had been a prisoner. I think he was captured in Dunkirk, at Dunkirk. So he'd been a prisoner of war during the war, and I came out of my dugout one night, and the moon was shining. And there he was standing, shaking his fist at the moon, saying, "We'll be attacked tonight. We'll be attacked tonight." And I thought, "Bloody hell! What the heck have I got here?"
But his nerve had gone a bit.
Yeah,
Major A.G. Anthony, was it?
Gibbon.
Do you know his first name?
I think they used to call him Carol Gibbon. I'm not sure.
But how did he show his nerves?
What?
How did he show his nerves?
Well, that was he showed it by was worried about being attacked, and that wasn't very long before, well, in a few days, he went and he left us and was sent home, and Ben Chapman, who was the 2IC of the company, was promoted to Major. And
now, what was Ben Chapman like? I know we
Ben,
didn't see
Ben
him,
but Chapman was all right. He was next. Well, he joined up, I believe, as a boy. His father was in the regiment. His father was a Major Quartermaster, and Ben had joined up, but he'd been in the PT Corps all during the war, so he hadn't seen any active service really, and he'd then been commissioned into the Royal Norfolk Regiment just at the end of the war, and when I rejoined the battalion in 1948, he was the signal officer.
And what was he like as a company commander?
He was all right. He was a good company commander.
In what way? What was good about him?
Well, he always led from the front. He was always willing to do a rotten job. He would always listen. And if he asked for advice, when I sort of offered advice, he would always listen. He didn't always take it, but he would always listen. And in after years, he's always said that he came to rely on my advice quite a bit. But he was a good company commander. Looked after his people he was in charge of, and always did his best for us.
Now, just to look at, so what about Colonel Oliver? What was he like?
Well, he was all right, but once again, the commanding officer, you don't see much of him. I mean, he was down at the CP, at the command post. We didn't see very much of him. He came up to the company once or twice, but not, I mean, you didn't see him daily like you did the company commander.
Did the colonel have a big impact on a regiment? I mean, would a good colonel make all the difference?
Oh, yeah.
Was
Oliver
a good
colonel? Yeah, he was all right. I don't think he really struck as an outstanding personality like one other that we had eventually. But he was a good, adequate commanding officer.
And what about the second in command, Major Murdoch?
I didn't know much about him. I mean, they were down at the battalion command post, and we were always up in the line and didn't see very much of battalion quarters at all.
And the adjutant, Eberhardy?
Oh, Eberhardy I knew, because he was my company commander once in Germany.
So what was he like?
I think I'd better be very careful what I say. He was a fitness fanatic. I mean, he used to run about 15 miles into camp from when we were in Crowborough, I think. And in Germany, he was the same. And he eventually, I think, was a brigadier. But I can remember when we were in Crowborough, just before we went to Korea, I came up to Norfolk to the training area, Bodney. And we went back on August Bank Holiday Monday, and it pelted with rain all the flaming way. And I was riding a motorbike doing Donar for the battalion convoy. It was about 90-odd vehicles long. We went through the middle of London on August Bank Holiday afternoon, and when we got about 20 miles from camp, the major who was commanding the convoy said, "Go ahead and tell them we'll be in about 20 minutes, Sergeant Major." And I went in, and this is what Eberhardy was like. Eberhardy stood on the guardroom veranda, and I pulled up and saluted and said, "The battalion will be in about 20 minutes." And he said to me, "Have you got part four of the movement order with you, Sergeant Major?" And I was soaked through to the flaming skin, and I very nearly gave him the answer what you could do with his part four movement order. If that wasn't a stupid question to ask, it was for me. In fact, my company commander was standing with him, and the company commander said to me, "Sergeant Major, go and get yourself sorted out and dried out. I'll look after the company," and he did. So Eberhardy was that. He was a bit of a military fanatic, as I would call him.
Now, so what about the positions you'd taken up on the finger? Can you describe that position?
Well, once again, it was...
Or was it just the same?
Slit trench is on the forward part of the hill, and all your living accommodation on the rear half, around at the back of it, or down below. And things like you had to have a cookhouse for the company for the cooks. That was all made out of whatever we could scrounge, steal, or beg or borrow. I mean, we had number two cookers, petrol cookers, but things like hot plates and things like that we made out of old ammunition boxes and petrol feed, and that sort of made a hot plate for the food we kept warm on. We cut big oil drums in half and made places to have, we'd look for fires underneath them so you could have hot water for washing, rinsing and sterilising their utensils and that after they had had a meal. That sort of thing you had to make yourself. I mean, there was nothing provided.
Now, what about the dugouts and bunkers? Because I know they went to some men or some NCOs went to town on sort of.
Oh yeah.
Can
we
you describe
had,
your
yeah my
dugout,
well, my dugout
or bunker, whatever
a bunker. Yeah, it was dug into the hill. The last one I was rather quite a big one, but this one wasn't too big.
Describe this one first. We'll perhaps come.
It
to
was
the
a small one. Dug into the
How
hill.
Big?
Oh, about 6 foot by 6 foot, with overhead cover. We all had overhead cover, logs with some earth piled on top of it, and in it we made a fire out of an old shell case, knocked a few holes in the bottom of it, and had a drip feed of petrol into it. Made a chimney out of old tins or bits of shell cases, and that we were able to keep, you know, fairly warm and comfortable. Bed in there I personally had a camp bed, but if you didn't have a camp bed, you made one up out of pickets and old telephone wires or whatever you could get. But that everybody had a bunker of some sorts to sort of live in. You had to be give yourself, you had to have shelter, and especially during the winter, you couldn't live outside.
And what about the food? What food did you get?
Food was American food. A lot of it was turkeys and steaks and salmon steaks. The salmon steaks was the one thing. We used to get boxes of them, big, thick salmon steaks. And the blokes used to throw them away, wouldn't eat them, didn't like them. But ordinary steak and turkey and fresh vegetables. The food was quite good. It depended, of course, on what the cooks were like.
But what were yours like?
Ours were all right, because I supervised them, because I have an interest in making sure everybody is able to have adequate facilities for doing the job that they're meant to do. So if they've got to have slit trenches, they've got to be proper slit trenches. If they're cooks, they've got to have the cookhouse and all the bits and pieces that they need to be able to cook properly for the troops to make the thing a bit appetising. There's nothing worse than being doled up a load of slop just because a cook couldn't be bothered to do anything. So my cooks, I looked after the cookhouse, although it was a colour sergeant job. The colour sergeant was down at Aeslon, which was about 10 or 15 miles back. So he was never anywhere near to look after them. And I did all the admin, looking after them. So, and I'm rather keen on making sure that things are done properly.
And what about water supply and what, you know?
Well, water supply, that's all brought up in we had a truck with a tank on the back of it, a water truck. And that used to come up, and we used to fill up containers for the water. You didn't use running water wherever it was.
Was it not safe? I mean.
Well, no. It was the fact that you know, the water. It's imperative, really, to make sure that all the ingredients and water facilities and things like that are there and are safe for. You don't want everybody down with stomach troubles or anything.
Would you use this water? What water would you use for washing and shaving? I presume you tried to maintain that. Is that
well, yes. Well, yeah. Everybody washed and shaved every day.
Was it voluntary or was it enforced?
What,
washing and shaving?
Oh no, that was one of the things you had to do. There was nothing voluntary about it. If anyone didn't wash and shave, got the sharp edge of my blooming tongue very quickly. In fact, one of our young subalterns, we were. Trying to bluff the Chinese that the position was not, one of our positions wasn't occupied, and the platoon had to stay below ground all during the day. He weren't allowed to show themselves. And this young officer came down to the company command post one day, and he had a black ring around his neck. And I said to him, "You washed today, sir?" So he said, "Yeah." I said, "Do you take that blooming pyjama jacket off that you're wearing?" "Oh, no." I said, "Well, you want to take it off and have a wash then, because you've got a black mark all around your neck." And he hadn't. He'd washed sort of down there and no further. And it might be all right for him, but it wasn't all right for me, because it's just a bad example. I mean, if you expect people to wash and shave and keep themselves clean, then you have to do it yourself. Show it the example, and you can expect other people to do it.